arguing for appellant, and Mr. Charles Orbison arguing for the state.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. It looks like maybe it's election case day, because that's what I'm going to talk about, too. But mine's a little different. The appellants know in trial counsel knows, that we have the burden of preserving the record and of making sure that all the proper objections are there and everything like that. What I'm going to ask that you do is not impose the additional burden, the additional duty on trial counsel to be mind readers. And I think that if you say that the election in this case is sufficient, that's what you're imposing on us. Because there's not any specific evidence that the state differentiates that it relies on as proof for the charged offenses. I'm going to talk about that. And then secondly, I think that the election is inadequate because I don't know how an election could ever be adequate if there's not an instruction to the jury informing the jury of that election. Now, to that end, I'm going to have to talk about two cases that were not, well, one of them was out when I filed my brief, but it got filed, it got handed down the week that I filed my brief. So it's not in my brief, but it is in the state's brief. And the other case is Pope, which is an unpublished opinion out of this court. Matter of fact, some of the justices were on that panel, so I'm sure you're well aware of that. And I want to take some time to address both of those because I was not able to do that in the brief. First off, with regard to the state not specifically differentiating the specific evidence that we're talking about that supports the charges, that's Phillips. I mean, that's what they have to do. And it's really telling that in the trial court, they didn't say, this is the evidence that supports the counts. They don't say, other than we have X number of times that this happened in this time frame. And the state specifically says in its brief on page 15, I believe, the prosecution with particularity, pointed out what the testimony was that supported. And I would say that's disingenuous at best, because if you look at the transcript, if you look at the it's like somewhere around page 34 is where it begins, volume 4, when they're talking about the election and making the elections, what the state does is go through the recitation of each count and say, this is what the charge is, or the indictment says. This is what we're saying. Oh, she testified it happened more than 50 times. She testified it happened more than 4 times. We're going to elect one of the times for each year. Without anything else, that's all they say.
It seems like your position is just kind of a function of the atrocious number of times that this happened. I mean, and do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Sure, and I think that a lot of times these cases fall that way because perhaps, especially when you're dealing with the circumstance of a child that maybe can't articulate any details or facts. I would say that here we're talking about children that are the age of 13 to 17. So I don't think...
So, but what do you think... tell me what you think should have... how the state should have elected properly given
the
record and the number of times that this occurred.
I think they should have done what they did in Pope. I think in Pope they had exhibits, and they said, here's the date that we alleged, here's the testimony, here's the count that we're electing, and this is the testimony that supports that. I think we have to, especially given the honor about and the double jeopardy implications, you have to require something about the testimony. It happened, we elect the first time that she moved to Denton and lived in the apartment in Flower Mound and said that he touched her breast. We elect the time that he said that he got the new mattress. We elect the time that she said that there was a videotape made. Any specificity. I mean, we don't even have day, night. In Pope, the victim said, we know that there was a four-way between Thanksgiving and Christmas of this year. I know that he asked for oral sex the day before my birthday. There were some specific things that the state pointed to that, from what I can read of the Pope case, without, of course, seeing, what the evidence actually was, but from the court's opinion, it appears that there are specific things that they pointed to that precisely informed the appellant of what he was going to have to defend against. And then also, in that case in particular, Pope, they particularly informed the jury. And I think that's another essential element. I will say that in the state's brief, they say this happened lots, this happened multiple times, but they can't tell you anything else, and that's the problem with the case. And the reason they can't tell you anything else is because that type of testimony was not elucidated in the trial. I mean, if there had been more development of the testimony, there's plenty of evidence that these girls remembered specific things. They testified to dates that they moved places. I was interested in this boy at this time, somebody at Albertsons I was friends with, so I had to quit my job. I mean, there is plenty of testimony that we're not talking about a circumstance like a 5-year-old who can't put any context to it. The problem was that there were just vague global allegations without specific evidence. And so when it came time to elect, the state couldn't do it because they hadn't really offered the evidence that they needed, or if they had, they didn't draw the trial court's attention to it. And even more importantly, they never drew the jury's attention to it.
Well, it sounds like your complaint might really be legal and factual insufficiency.
Well, and you know, I really, really struggled with that because I really wanted to make that argument. I'm already at like 50-something pages on the brief with what we did, but in looking at it, I had a difficult time without knowing what the elections were of contesting the sufficiency of the evidence. And I think Phillips, they drop a footnote, and I think I've cited it in the brief as well, that it becomes impossible at some point, if you're not told of what the jury's relying on for the conviction, for me to come on an appeal and say there wasn't sufficient evidence when I don't really know what the jury found him guilty of. And so I do think that there's an overlap with sufficiency, but I think that at some point it becomes too untenable to be able to make the argument if you aren't given the relevant information to begin with to figure out what the convictions were. Back to the thing on charges, I mean, I think it's really important. If you look at the prosecution, if you look at the state's arguments in closing, never, not one time do they refer to any specific testimony, not once. All they talk about is the general credibility of the witnesses. They never refer the court to, or the jury to, hey, we've got this date, and remember, you heard testimony of X, Y, and Z. In Pope, on the other hand, that's exactly what they did. And not only that, but the prosecution went further, went through the chart and went through every one of the 40 allegations, the 40 elected offenses, and said, this is the evidence that supports that. And I would submit that they did one better, which is they pretty much gave the instruction that the trial court should have given to begin with. The trial court didn't give an instruction in the charge about the election, but the state sort of cured that. I hate to say that word. I take that back. The state actually got up and said, we've got all these different offenses. We have 50 to 75 extraneous in addition to the 40 that we've talked about. But I'm going to go through the evidence with you, and every one of these I'm going to show you what specific evidence supports those 40, and you're not allowed to consider the other 50 to 75 for any reason other than intents, et cetera, et cetera. So the jury was sort of informed of what it had to do, and that's what ends up missing here, is because of the fact that we don't have that, which leads me to the second part of why I don't think we have an adequate election. And this is not really articulated in my brief because I think this stems from Duffy, and I have to say I wasn't smart enough to think about it. In Duffy, the court in Dallas, it's an unpublished opinion, but they take specific issue with Eisenhower as opposed to in interpreting the harm analysis. But in Duffy, they say, you know, part and parcel of giving an election is informing the jury. It doesn't matter if this state elects and the trial court requires the state to elect. If the trial court never tells the jury what the election is, it's null and void. It makes no difference. And I would say that it's that communication missing that also makes this an ineffective election. Because not only did we not get notice, but then you have the issue of unanimity. So we've got two constitutional protections that aren't given out of the four that are set forth in Phillips. The trial court has a duty of discerning the legal effect of the election and explaining it. And I don't think the election's accomplished without both. I think once the appellant said, I want to exercise my right to election, I want you to elect, that became the law of the case. We're not talking about a defensive issue here. That became the law of the case, and the trial court had to tell him that. And I would say it more goes along the lines of like an accomplice witness, where once it's the law of the case, you've trial court, sua sponte, required to give the election. I know that in that particular case, Duffy said, because there's no instruction, there's no election, so we have to apply the constitutional review. And in particular, they were also concerned about notice and unanimity. Now, in that case, they ended up finding that it was harmless, but I'll kind of get into that hopefully in a minute as to why and why that's different than our case. Also, I would point out that in Pope, this court didn't get an opportunity to review this issue. Because in Pope, not only did the state concede that there was no instruction, but there was nothing, from what I can tell, that was raised regarding the constitutional issues. It appeared that the appellant's point of error concerned whether or not the trial court abused its discretion in denying the instruction. They didn't specifically raise the point of, we've got this constitutionality issue of unanimity and notice. In Duffy, I'll just say real quick while I'm thinking about it, in Duffy, the reason that it ended up not being harmful is because there was only one instance. There was that one instance that the testimony clearly pointed to, and in closing argument, the state emphasized that one instance. So I would say that on that one, maybe the harm factor is because there's not really multiple instances that unanimity would have been affected to begin with, as opposed to our case where we're talking about, well, they say literally thousands of instances. I know the state's probably going to say that we waived this. I know that in the brief, they, to use one of their favorite things, they try and lead the court down a rabbit trail by saying that since there's not an adequate limiting instruction, that it's not their fault, it's our fault. But first off, I think that trial counsel did an admirable job of trying to preserve evidence in this case and asking for everything at every turn. But how can the appellant be expected to give a limiting instruction when the appellant is saying, I don't know what evidence the state has elected? And that's what he said over and over again. Trial counsel said, I don't know what we're electing here. Which offenses are we talking about? Even saying, can you narrow it to Flower Mound or Argyle? Can we figure out whether you're trying to convict him of offenses that happened after she turned 17? You know, there's no narrowing of it. And how would we craft any kind of limiting request or instruction based on that? I think that that's inherently a problem. The state actually says that 3616 is what requires that. I think it's actually 3614, 3615, depending upon whether it's an objection or an instruction. And part of this is my fault because I say in my point of error, I couch it in terms of a request. And maybe that was not the most artful way to do it, because I think that from reading the record, it's clear the trial court made the trial counsel made objections and requests. Now, sometimes he used the magic word objection, and sometimes he didn't. But when he didn't use the magic word objection, he referred the court back to all the objections that he'd made about unanimity and double jeopardy. And so I think that it's clear that the court was well aware of what the argument was, of what we were asking for. And again, even after the charge was read, the trial counsel said again, you know, does that mean I want you to instruct the jury on the election? And the court said, we've already ruled on that. We've heard that. And the prosecutor said, yeah, we've already ruled on that. You denied that. So I think the trial court was well aware of what appellant was asking for, and that would be sufficient to apprise it of what it needed to include in the jury charge. And if the court didn't have an understanding of what that language should be, well, then maybe they should have hashed that out. But certainly the objection was made, and I think that's sufficient to prove that. And even if it were not, even under an egregious error standard, I still think that we have harm here, and I'm going to guess I'm probably going to talk about that on rebuttal. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Moore.
May it please the court. It's no day at the beach arguing against Don Moore ever. It's especially not very pleasurable when you haven't written the brief. And so, I will confess, read the entire record. Simply no time. I beg you on your indulgence because I was not the attorney who wrote the brief. But I will do my best. One point that opposing counsel did not bring up, and I think it's because we had a conversation before and she didn't feel the need to, is in the ex post facto claims. This would affect counts 5 through 8. There were 12 counts altogether. There were 8 against the older daughter. There were 4 against the younger daughter. In counts 5 through 8, we alleged contact between the sexual organ of appellant and the sexual organ of the older daughter. And we enhanced through a relatively new provision, subsection F of 22.011. The problem that I don't think anybody caught at trial is that subsection F of 22.011 did not take effect until September 1st of 2005. Now that becomes a problem when you realize that the victim in counts 5 through 8 turned 17 June 20th, 2005. Therefore, that was not available for enhancement as to her. There was criminal activity that continued after she was 17, but we didn't charge that. So I believe the court can only reverse as to 5 through 8 on the punishment that was assessed because it was outside the range that should be assessed, and remand for a new punishment trial on 5 through 8. If there are any questions about that, I can. All right, now we go to election. Well, by the way, there's a real handy chart that the brief writer provides the court on page 12 of the brief, and I have referred to that quite frequently in preparing. So if you ever get confused of who's on first, that chart really kind of helps. Mr. Stride, who wrote the state's brief in this case, basically says, well, you know, there was an election. May not be the election that defense counsel wanted, but there was an election. And so the real issue here is a jury charge issue, that there was an instruction that either delineated those offenses elected or excluded those offenses that would then become extraneous. And he's absolutely right. All of that is correct within the record. But as Ms. Moore has been arguing before you today, is this election was no election. And I'm going to offer another way of looking at that that might help the court as it looks at this issue. What we had here is pretty much exactly what was present in the Dixon case. The Dixon case, the Supreme Court version of that case is at 201 Southwest 3rd, 731. It was cited in both briefs, but that's what we had. As the Supreme Court, as the Court of Criminal Appeals says, all the incidents presented in the case were presented with equal specificity. And except for the fact that one incident happened during the day and 99 happened at night, there was nothing to separate them. That's what we have here. There is nothing to separate these numerous sexual assaults on his daughters. Now, counsel identified two things, and I actually, as I read the record, the relevant part of the record, I actually identified three things that were somewhat added some specificity. As we talk about the eldest daughter testimony only, as we talk about the younger daughter, there's absolutely nothing. There is nothing on which to distinguish these offenses. But as we talk about the eldest daughter, the first specific detail she gave, excuse me, was in reference to when it all first began. Well, obviously, the state couldn't elect that. There were some details there about how it all started the first time. The state couldn't elect that because that happened in Brownfield, Texas. It was a different county. The second amount of details that were provided in the record was upon the move to Flower Mound. and an assault that occurred, I think, the second night in Flower Mound. And really, the only detail was the eldest daughter remembered that they had new mattresses and that appellant had said, "We've got new mattresses. I want to break them in and have sex with you." And that's the detail. Could the state have elected that specific detail as to count four? Yes, it could have, I suppose. I suppose it could have, as to count four. I don't know how meaningful it would have been, but I suppose there is an argument that could be made there. The last time when any specific details were given was the videotaping of an instance of oral sex. But as opposing counsel admits in her brief, that more than likely happened after the child turned 17. Obviously, the state is not going to elect that. So out of the three possible things the state could have elected, there was only one, really. One happened outside of Denton County. One happened after the age of 17. There was only one. And so as to count four, possibly the state could have provided guidance to defense counsel on that. Seems to me what we really have here is everybody trying to do it right, but really they couldn't because of the evidence. I mean, defense counsel, who's with us today, tried to do the right thing. He knew that he had a right to an election. He asked for it, and he persistently asked for it, as he should have. The state acknowledged on the record that it was required to elect upon that request. And so it did the best it could. It was a little better than what opposing counsel said. As to the youngest daughter, the testimony was, did it happen twice before you were 14? Yes, it did. Did it happen twice before you were 17? Yes, it did. And then did it happen a lot of other times? Yeah, it happened a lot more after that, too. But there was those specific questions asked of the youngest girl. There was also a little bit more specificity in how the questions were asked as to the eldest daughter, not quite as to the youngest. So we have the defense counsel trying to do the right thing. We have the state trying to do the right thing. We have the court, I guess, trying to do the right thing. Everybody, but it's just kind of impossible to do it the way that the textbook would have you do it. There was just no way. What's the state going to say? You know, she talks about how could defense counsel possibly have written an instruction? Well, how could the court have written an instruction? How could anybody have written an instruction that with any specificity? There just wasn't any. So what we really have is what was present in Dixon. And so as we look at Dixon, we see the way to handle it in the harm analysis. And in Dixon, it's a constitutional harm analysis. Certainly the court can go that way if it holds that there was, in effect, no election. If the court wants to hold that, well, you know, there was a technical election, then we probably don't get to constitutional harm analysis. We get to a harm analysis under a jury charge error, as outlined in the state's brief, and we have to ask ourselves, is it egregious harm or some harm? And that of course centers on whether a proper objection or request was made. Well, we know that the defense attorney asked for an instruction. But under 3615, if you want a special instruction, you have to provide it to the court. And that wasn't done. Now, opposing counsel said what he objected. You got to do one or the other, either object or provide the language of an instruction. Well, that's not an objection. He's not objecting to things in the charge. He's asking for something to be put in the charge. Earlier in the charge conference that the court will read, he did object to language that was in the charge, and he asked that those be removed. That's an objection. But that's a different issue. He wanted the meaning of the on or about language removed. But if you want an instruction, then you got to submit it. So my view is that you would look at egregious harm and not some harm. But you know what? Even if you do some harm, the lesson of Dixon is still there as it looks at constitutional harm. The analysis would be almost identical, in my opinion. So Dixon, it seems to me, is the key. Now, I know the appellant presents a couple of cases pre-Dixon, and that's the important part to remember. Pardon me. Where the 14th Circuit held in three cases, actually, that there was harmful error. Much different facts, and that's what really boggles the mind as you get into this. The cases are all different. Pope, much different facts under Pope, this court's own case. But under Phillips and Farr, the 14th Court found harmful error. And it went to the Court of Criminal Appeals. And everything was affirmed. But what was raised before the Court of Criminal Appeal in those two cases was not the manner of the harm analysis. It was the type of harm analysis. And so the Court of Criminal Appeal said, yeah, if we don't have an election, we should do a constitutional 44.2A harm analysis. State is not disputing that. That's clear in Phillips. But Phillips didn't look at how that harm analysis was carried out because that wasn't an issue in the case. It later became an issue with the same court, 14th Court, in Dixon. In Dixon, the 14th Court found harm. And now, this time, it is raised the manner of that harm analysis. And here the Court of Criminal Appeals settles the issue and says, here is how we're going to do this constitutional harm analysis, and it reverses the 14th Court because they found harm when there wasn't any. And I refer you to that Dixon case because that is the solution, it seems to me. Interestingly, in Dixon, Justin Cochran writes in a concurrence, and she says, you know, we're headed for trouble here. This is just crazy. And she calls upon the legislature to pass a law, something continuous sexual activity with the child. And you know what? The legislature did it. But that took effect in 07, well before the offenses in this case. That would have solved the problem here. Probably we all would admit that. But it wasn't available. So Dixon is the answer as far as the state's position is concerned. I see my yellow light is up. I don't want to, if there are any questions by the panel, not hearing any, the state would have asked for affirmance of the judgment below. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Robertson. Ms. Moore, rebuttal.
I'd like to say briefly, but I think that wouldn't be truthful, so I'm probably going to take every second of my time. You know, I know this is hard. These are bad cases. The facts are bad. It's difficult. But the problem is that when we allow for a single conviction based on global allegations, we open up the possibility of multiple convictions for the same offense against the defendant in the same trial and in different trials. And I think that we have to stay true to what the purpose of it is. What we're trying to do is make sure that doesn't happen, that those rights are protected. And so I know that I agree. I think that the legislature realized that there was a problem and we enacted the continuous conduct, although if I'm remembering correctly, and I haven't had to try one of those cases since then, I think it only applies to 14 and under. I don't think it's 14 to 17 on that, but I may be wrong. I may not remember that correctly. But anyway, so my point of that is that some of that wouldn't necessarily cover the issue we have here because some of this conduct is relating to when at least one of the victims was 14 to 17. So maybe it would have corrected it, maybe it wouldn't have. But either way, we have to deal with it now, and we have to deal with it because potentially they could retry on other things. They said there's 2,000 of them. I mean, if we come back on a trial, what is it that we're supposed to prepare that he was convicted of? One of the things I do want to point out is that the state says that some of these offenses that I admit that they occurred after she was 17. Okay, that's true. But the problem is that the state, in the court's charge and what the state elected, were actually dates when the offense could not have been committed because of her age. If you look at the state's, it's on counts 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8, I guess. They allege at one point July 15th, September 15th, and November 15th of 2005. She turned 17 in June. And then they also elect January 15th and March 16th of 2006. So their election, what's submitted in the charge, I mean, they don't actually elect dates, but what's submitted in the charge ultimately are those dates when she's not even under 17 anymore. So we exacerbate the harm because when the state got up there, not only did they say, all we have to do is give you an honor about date. We don't have to prove that date. And by the way, we're not going to tell you what evidence supports that date, but you're going to do the math and figure out that during a lot of these offenses, she wasn't even under 17. So this crime couldn't have occurred. Maybe there was some other kind of crime, like prohibited sexual contact. But this crime couldn't have occurred. But you don't have to worry about that, because honor about means that we don't have to show that she was under 17 at the time. And that's pretty much what they say in the closing argument, maybe almost verbatim. So please take a look at that. I think that Dixon is distinguishable because they're saying there was some specific instance, and then we said, oh, it happened 15 times exactly the same way. A lot of the cases that you look at, when you look at Halsey and Farr and Duffy and Demps, you're going to see that there's either global, general, specific, no specificity, which is what we have here, or there's one specific time, and then they say this is the same way it happened every time, and then there's additional details that maybe give that time frame. So it's not the same. It's just not. We would ask that you do what's hard on this and realize that there's no way for this to have been corrected by the appellant, that the state should have offered testimony, should have clarified its testimony, should have elected, and the trial court was required to tell the jury what the election was. And without that, there is no constitutional protection for appellant from retrial or from jury unanimity issues in this case, or even to ever say that he was convicted of anything that they allege. They could have been convicted in Brownsville or after she was 17, because we don't know. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Moore. Mr. Orbison, we appreciate your arguments today and your briefing. Your case is submitted. We'll take about a 15-minute recess before we pick up our 10:30 docket. Thank you.